Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church Fellowship of Manhattan. My name is Michael Oldfather. For about 100 times in the past 20 years, it's been my honor to serve as the morning's convener. As the temporary face of the congregation, convener is charged with the responsibility to get the proceedings started at 10:45 and concluded no later than noon. Along the way, the convener's duties include supporting a modicum of decorum and encouraging speakers to use one of the microphones so that remarks can be recorded for those who listen to the service at a later time and so that people wearing the headsets can hear what is said. Succinct comments and questions from the floor are appreciated but optional. While our liturgical practices can best be described as flexible, we do have a routine. The first required element in that routine is to welcome members, friends, and visitors without regard to their age, ethnicity, sexual orientation, economic status, political affiliation, and personal vision of what it means to be part of a liberal, creedless tradition. The final element in our tradition is the sharing of light refreshments and spirited discussion immediately following the speaker's closing words. In between the gracious, inclusive welcome and our version of communion, all bets are off. There are people wearing name tags like this for you visitors who might want to know more about us, and there is information available in the narthex and online at UUFM.net. There are announcements in the order of service in the Sunday bulletin there. I have one other. Nobody has handed me anything else, but one other which is not there is that autographed copies of our speakers' books are available for nominal charge in the narthex following the service. We move now to lighting the chalice. So Larry will help in a minute. UU speaker or minister Mark Morrison Reed wrote the following words for us to think about as we light the chalice this morning. The central task of the religious community, he writes, is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all. There is a connectedness, a relationship discovered amid the particulars of our own lives and the lives of others. Once felt, it inspires us to act for justice. It is the church that assures that we are not struggling for a justice on our own, but as members of a larger community. The religious community is essential, for alone, our vision is too narrow to see all that must be seen, and our strength is limited to do all that must be done. Together, our vision widens our strength, and is our strength is renewed. In a minute, we will sing our first hymn. The tune of that hymn is named Nicaea. The first words set to the melody celebrated the decision in 325 CE at the Council of Nicaea to support the establishment of the Trinity of the Christian God. Borrowing good music to support new sets of words is an ancient and honorable tradition, which includes setting the Star-Spangled Banner to the tune of a somewhat bawdy drinking song. So it's okay for Unitarians to use Trinitarian songs without apology, but with full attribution. If you'll stand as you're able and turn to 290, we will sing Bring Old Past Your Honor.
Thank you.
This would be a good time for children of all ages to come to the front.
Thank you. Keep coming. Come on. Back up a little bit. Psst. Back up a little bit. Make some more room up there. Got a good crowd here today. Yeah, we're not that way.
Well, good morning. I know, and we've all been told that y'all have been taking some trips, some of those trips just in your minds, but that's a good place to go to. Yes, it is. I want to tell you my grandson, Graham, a few years ago was very fascinated with the governors of New York, the state where he lives, and the presidents. And one of those presidents, Martin Van Buren, or one was also a governor of New York. So he and I drove 50 miles down the Ohio, or down the that other river, the Hudson, thank you, river, and visited Van Buren's home. Today, as we speak, Graham and one of his grandmothers are in Oxford, England, and they are there as part of a group of grandchildren and their grandparents who are fans of, who do you suppose they are fans of if they are in Oxford, England? Somebody's got to know. Harry Potter. And so they are visiting places where Harry Potter's story evolves and where scenes of the movies have occurred. This grandmother has raised the bar for other grandparents of these children. But what I would like to do is maybe if you would very quickly, one or two of you or three of you, whatever, tell about some of the places you've been, one of them or whatever, in your mind that was important and interesting. Where did you go that you'd...
Rhode Island.
All right. That's a pretty exciting place. Not a very big one, but pretty exciting. Who else? Where did you go? Where did you go in the Sunday school? In the church school? Where did you go? Religious education? In your mind, did you go to Japan?
I don't have any.
Oh, these lessons have really stuck.
Rochester, New York.
Rochester, New York. All right.
We went to Japan.
Japan, all right, thank you. These are the places they went. Now, here's what I'm guessing, and is that there are people out there who have taken trips that were important to them, interesting, or maybe they've got them planned for soon during the summer, and if somebody would be willing to say just a word or two about those trips, well, if not, this will go a lot faster, but if somebody will, all right, Marilyn.
A few years ago, we went to the Greek islands on sailboats, and that was a lot of fun.
Who else? Somebody else. Pardon me.
Going to California in a few weeks.
Oh, where?
I don't really know.
You'll have lots of choices.
Long ago, I went to Greece, but classical Greece was closed because of a strike, so I had to break into the various sites.
And you're now out of jail. All right.
Well, I just got back from a trip to Italy. And if some of you looked at the front page of the Mercury today, you'll see my picture along with the rest of the choir. And speaking of Trinitarian, by the way, there I was at the seat of the most Catholic of Catholic churches, St. Peter's Basilica, singing at the main altar as a Unitarian.
Yay! Mike?
Last year, my wife and I went on a spur-of-the-moment trip to San Francisco to see the rest of what's left of the Grateful Dead with 2 days' notice.
Mark?
Yesterday, we took the astounding journey to Junction City to see the Hildebrand Dairy, which I highly recommend for anyone who has children, especially.
Anybody else?
Well, currently, I just got back from California. San Diego, the nights were cool, and the days got warmed up quite a bit in the afternoon, but got to see my son and his new house.
All right.
My husband Chuck and I have often visited the Far East, and this is the result of his son, who has a teaching position at the National University of Singapore. So we have had the good fortune of being in Singapore, being in Japan, which is the home of his Eric's wife, Mayumi, Thailand, Cambodia, and Chuck has been to Indonesia, Java, etc. So love to talk to anybody who wants to go to those places or who would like to chat about them.
Oh, Connor. All right.
I am going to Rock Springs, Kansas today.
Well, that seems to be about it. You're going to have other trips. Now, when I ask you next time, maybe you'll remember some of these places that you visited because people came in and told you about them. That's part of the idea. I bet you had a good time. All right.
We also went to Disney World.
Disney World. All right. You had a great time. All right. Well, see you.
Go now, please. Go now.
Where you may go.
This is the time in our service when people are encouraged to tell us about meaningful events in their lives, their joys, their sorrows, their concerns. as you raise your hand, the microphone will come your way.
Aunt Cowan, I'm sure that some of you have seen this announcement, but a sister UU society in River Falls, Wisconsin, has experienced a terrible tragedy. Three children in one of the families were killed this past week by an estranged father. So that society is suffering, as with the family, and we should keep them in our thoughts.
I just wanted to give a good news update on our daughter who had been diagnosed with leukemia just a few weeks ago, has now gone through three chemotherapies a day for a number of weeks and has managed them very well, and so she's on a vacation in the hospital to keep her from being infected with anything. But we're delighted with how things are proceeding. And
we have our son Steve with us. Came in, plane was late last night, and we got home at 1:30, which is the latest we've been out for a long time. And then he's going with us on a trip, family reunion this week.
Inel Forrester, I bring greetings from Mary Westfall. She was supposed to be here this morning, but was able to, her house has been sold, so she came in a quick trip to clean it out and prepare it for the new residents. And so she's leaving this morning, and she said to say hello to all of you who remember her. She says she promises to come back and visit.
I'm Barbara Bascom, and we have a really one really big joy. We have our one of our closest friends who lives in California had a heart transplant last week, and is sitting in a chair and able to give messages on the phone and doing extremely well. And what a miracle that process is. It's incredible. His name is Steve Nocetti, so send nice thoughts to Steve. The other news is that we are contemplating another move, and we have closed on a house in a retirement community in the state of Washington. So we'll be leaving you again after a very nice year, and that's and we're sad about that. But it's the good news is that we made it in time to hear Ron Knapp speak to us, because we had to leave Santa Fe last year in August, a couple of weeks before he was the guest speaker there.
We will save your name tags just in case. We see you again.
Jim Chanteau. Following the trip to Italy that I took, I went on a cruise with my family to celebrate my retirement after 41 years at K-State. We had a marvelous time together, both on the ship and off the ship. I guess the family that snorkels together stays together. That was our motto.
For the record, Tom Phillips. Let's see, a joy and a concern. My doctor said I should exercise, so I rode my bike this morning, and I'm still alive. And I feel good. And I rode around to some local churches because I'd read in the paper that they'd be visited by Westboro Baptist out of Topeka. And then I'm reminded that I live in the state, the same state that Fred Phelps lives in. And it was amazing because being a lifelong Christian, it was perhaps a demonstration of the most unchristian behavior I can imagine. So anyway, and I was I had to inform a friend who just moved here from Texas. I said, "You realize what we have in Kansas that you don't have in Texas." So.
Oh, Kansas, bigger than you think. You remember that bumper sticker?
Kathleen Oldfather, and looks like Sam Zeller has maybe left the room too to help with the kids, but for people that don't know, Sam Zeller and Corey Zeller, our former DRE, and their children are going to move to Chicago at the end of July. Sam has accepted a position with a firm there, and I guess his mother is very ill, so they're wanting to be closer to her.
Enel Forrester again. Tom, you brought up an idea. Why don't you use a go and picket their church in Topeka with decent signs?
Well, if there are no more, I have a couple. One of them is that former member Chris Cervantes is here with her sons, and welcome back. We're nice to have you with us. We miss you. And since nobody else seems interested in mentioning it, today is Dan Swenson's birthday. Am I right? See, they were talking and they didn't hear. Happy birthday. All right. Well, there are undoubtedly other joys and concerns that you have chosen not to share, but are of importance to you, and we join you in recognizing them in our silence. I'm going to introduce our speaker for the first reading, but before I do, let me just kind of move on ahead. Following the reading of John Milton's work, we will move to the offertory, and while it's sad to miss Slavomir, he will be back soon, and a little Chopin recorded is a poor substitute, but it's what we have. But as the baskets are passed, we hope you will remember with your gifts the church we all love and feel an important part of. Ron Knapp has been here many times. He and I have known each other for over 40 years, and we have gone through serious illnesses and family tragedies and crises, maybe is the better word, and then an awful lot of really good time. And it's always a treat to have him in the pulpit. He'll read and then take over from there. Welcome, Ron.
With the hymns, Michael, total attribution? Total attribution. Well, one of my, I speak at a lot of fellowships in my retirement, and one of the things I do is sing authentic Unitarian Universalist hymns, which less and less and less and less are being sung in Unitarian churches. More and more they're singing songs or hymns that could be sung in any church in the country. So by God, you're going to sing some Unitarian hymns this morning. That's one attribution. The other is the hymn you sang this morning was written by one of my predecessors at First Unitarian Church in Omaha. From John Milton, our faith and knowledge thrive by exercise as well as our limbs and complexion. If the waters of truth flow not in perpetual progression, they sicken into a muddy pool of conformity and tradition. We boast our light, but if we look not wisely on the sun itself, it smites us into darkness. The light which we have gained was given us not to be ever staring on, but by it to discover things more remote from our knowledge. Where there is much desire to learn, there of necessity will be much arguing, much writing, many opinions. A little generous prudence, a little forbearance of one another, and some grain of charity might win all these diligences to join and unite in one general and brotherly and sisterly search after truth. Ron Knapp added the sisterly, by the way. Give me liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience above all liberties. And though the winds of doctrine were let loose to play upon the earth, so truth be in the field, we do injuriously to misdoubt her strength. For who knows not that truth is strong next to the Almighty? She needs no policies, no stratagems to make her victorious. Let her and falsehood grapple. Who ever knew truth put to worse in a free and open encounter? It's a pleasure to be back in this church fellowship with you again. I believe it was Mark Twain who said something to the effect that when he was a child, he didn't think his father knew very much. But when he grew up, he was surprised to discover how much the old man had learned in the past few years. I sometimes think that way about my own father. This is especially true when it comes to the pithy aphorisms that he would use to describe people or events. When I was a graduate student at Dartmouth, I took a seminar on revolution and social change and became interested in the question of why revolutionary ideals are so seldom implemented when the revolutionaries actually become the rulers. Most of my waking hours for an entire summer focused on this question. I read a great deal about revolutionary theory, focused on two particular revolutionary movements, the Russian Revolution and the Indian National Movement, and I wrote a lengthy paper on this question. My major thesis had to do with characteristics of time. Revolutionary ideals, I decided, are in a sense timeless. That is, they exist in the revolutionary's mind in a simultaneous fashion, all at the same time. But implementation of those ideals has to take place over time. And as time passes, a lot of obstacles have to be overcome, many of which are never overcome. That paper, which was supposed to be 8 or 10 pages in length for the seminar, turned out to be 50 or 60 pages. And I remember being concerned about whether or not my professor would accept such a lengthy seminar paper, or for that matter, even bother to read it. But I handed it in and conducted my seminar session with my professor actually appreciating all the work I had done. I began the last chapter of my paper with some lines from Archibald MacLeish's Epistle to be Left in the Earth. I will tell you all that I have learned. I will tell you everything. The earth is round. There are springs under the orchards. The loam cuts with a sharp knife. Beware of elms and thunder. The light in the sky are stars. Archibald MacLeish listed only 5 things he had learned. I had the audacity to list 40 things I had learned. The item on that list that most impressed my professor, however, was one of those aphorisms of my father. My professor felt this to be the best answer to my question of why the ideals of revolutionaries so seldom find fulfillment when the revolutionaries become the rulers. Now, perhaps before I give you my father's saying, I need to tell you that my father never used 4-letter words. He wasn't a Unitarian. So here it is, a bit of down-home wisdom. If you told my father you wished for something, he would say, wish in one hand, poo-poo in the other, rub them both together, and what have you got? Poo-poo in both hands. It is, however, another one of my father's bits of down-home wisdom that brings me to my topic for today. It is what my father would say about someone who doesn't know what they're doing, someone who has lost their way, someone who is confused. He is someone, my father would say, who climbs on a horse and rides off in all 4 directions at the same time. And that, in my opinion, describes Unitarian Universalism as we begin the second decade of the 21st century. As a movement, we don't seem to know who we are, where we come from, where we're going. As a movement, we no longer seem to have any viable core. As a movement, we seem to have denigrated reason and rationalism, which has been historically and traditionally the lifeblood of our movement. As a movement, we seem to be ignoring our living heritage connected with the past. As a movement, we seem to have lost our way. In a word, we have become like someone who climbs on a horse and rides off in all 4 directions at the same time. And I say this because I feel that if we continue on this path, if we do not recapture our core, if we do not restore reason and rationality to its central place in our ideology, if we do not see ourselves in the context of a vital, living, historical heritage, there will be a continual dumbing down of our message, a descent into irrelevancy. And this movement, which I love, and which I have given most of my adult life to, may well go, as it now appears to be doing, into another one of its historic and periodic declines. At the core of what I see as the central problem in liberal religion today is what I call our obsession with diversity. Right now, diversity seems to be the central message of our denomination. It is found everywhere. It sometimes seems to me to resemble old McDonald's farm. Here a diversity, there a diversity, everywhere a diversity, diversity. It seems to me that we could once say about our religion, come, Let us reason together. Now it seems to be, come, let us be diverse. Sometimes it seems to me like we are in the process of becoming the Unitarian Universalist Association of Dilettantes. In our obsession with diversity, we seem to be almost suggesting that in our churches and fellowships, all points of views are respected. Of course, that's not true. We don't respect racist views or homophobic views. And for me personally, and I would expect for many, most probably all of you, I do not respect the views of those extreme fundamentalists who burn the Quran, or those persistent attempts to destroy proper teachings of science in our public schools, or those nuts from Topeka who picket the funeral of gay servicemen. 20 years ago or more, I was working in my church office late one night when I received an interesting phone call. It was from a young gay man who thought he was calling the Metropolitan Community Church, which for a number of years met in the Unitarian Church of Omaha. When I informed him that he had reached the Unitarian Church and that I was the minister there, he wanted to know something about Unitarianism. He wanted to know, for example, if an openly gay man would be welcome in the church. I assured him that we had a number of gay and lesbian members in our church and that, of course, he would be welcome. But he went on to say that he was a fundamentalist and believed in things like the virgin birth and that the world was created in seven literal days. Would those views, he said, be welcome? I told him that, of course, he could come to our church, whatever he believed, but that he would be awfully uncomfortable holding those fundamentalist beliefs in a Unitarian church. There have always been two vital dimensions to liberal religion, breadth on the one hand and depth on the other. We're doing quite well with the breadth dimension, pluralism and diversity, but we seem to be more and more and more ignoring the depth dimension. Can it really be that the only thing we have to offer to the world as a church or this fellowship is diversity? Now, so I won't be completely misunderstood, before I ruffle too many feathers or get lynched, I need to make two very important caveats. So let's try to make it clear what I'm trying to say, even though some people will even afterwards say I'm saying something that I'm not. In the first place, as I deal with the question of diversity, you need to understand that I'm not dealing with racial or cultural or sexual orientation. I'm aware of how important that is in our movement, and I support it entirely. What I am talking about is religious diversity, theological diversity, ideological diversity, the myriad variety of religious convictions that characterize people in this fellowship, in my church, and in Unitarian Universalism. In the second place, you need to know, and I can't stress this strongly enough, as I discuss what I call our obsession with diversity, that I have no quarrel at all with the rich and abundant diversity of belief systems found in this fellowship, in the church in Omaha, or in our larger movement. The liberal religious tradition, Unitarian Universalism, as well as our own churches and fellowships, have always been characterized by religious and theological and ideological diversity. Freedom of the few, as well as freedom of the pulpit, is an enduring aspect of our liberal religious heritage. Diversity of opinion has always been and continues to be a very important and valuable reality in liberal religion. So please believe me when I tell you that I believe that too. But having said what I just said, and given the importance of diversity in our historical tradition as well as contemporary reality, diversity begs some very important questions. Questions which revolve around a central question. Why is diversity important? Is diversity more important, a valuable end in itself? My answer clearly is no, it is not. Is diversity some sort of ultimate value? Again, my answer is no. As an end in itself, diversity can lead to little more than unproductive chaos. As an ultimate value, diversity can lead us into positions where we say to one another, and I hear people say this to one another, I believe what I believe, and you believe what you believe, and that is the end of the matter. It should not be the end of the matter. Diversity can, an obsession with diversity can readily lead to what I have called from the pulpit on numerous occasions the cardinal sin of liberal religion, believing what you want to believe. As adherents of liberal religion, we're not called to believe what we want to believe. We're called to believe what we are required to believe by the active and critical workings of our own free minds. As William Ellery Channing put it more than 2 centuries ago, I call that mind free, which jealously guards its intellectual rights and powers, which does not content itself with a passive or hereditary faith, which opens itself to light whensoever it may come, which receives new truth as an angel from heaven. Now I ask, on the other hand, is diversity contextual? And my answer this time is yes, it is. Is diversity, that is, a facet of a more overarching value, a more overarching value that is of central and foundational importance to liberal religion? Again, I say it is. And what is that context? What is that which is of central and foundational importance to liberal religion? It is the continuing and probably never-ending search for truth and the expectation that we are united, that we are one in that search. This aspect of the role of diversity was wonderfully expressed by somebody I consider to be one of our more important ideological and intellectual forebears, John Milton, found in the selection I read a little bit ago. Even though that was written almost 4 centuries ago, it still speaks to me and can speak to us today. We boast our light, but if we look not wisely on the sun itself, it smites us into darkness, Milton wrote. And then, the light we have gained was given us not to be ever staring on, but by it to discover onward things more remote from our knowledge. Our faith and knowledge thrive by exercise, Milton wrote. And by exercise, what he meant was a vigorous competition between ideas, a rigorous interaction between the diverse opinions individuals may hold. Where there's much desire to learn, there of necessity will be much arguing, much writing, many opinions, Milton wrote, and then goes on to attempt to bring these thoughts into focus. A little generous prudence, a little forbearance of one another, and some grain of charity might win all these diligences, all these diversities to join and unite in one brotherly and sisterly search after truth. This desire to learn, that process of seeking after truth, which Milton insisted must flow in a perpetual progression, this united search for truth is what Unitarian Universalism, ideally at least, is or ought to be about. And this is where diversity becomes important. Now, just as an obsession with diversity tends to obscure the central characteristic of liberalism, the search for truth, as I mentioned earlier, it also tends to militate against another valuable aspect of liberalism. That is the importance of doubt to religious liberals. When one English poet, Alfred Lord Tennyson, wrote, "There is more faith in honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds, And when another English poet, Philip James Bailey, adds, "Who never doubted, never half believed," Unitarian Universalists and other liberal thinkers across time have certainly replied, "Amen." Religious liberalism, as it finds expression in Unitarian Universalism, perhaps more than almost every other form of religious conviction, sees doubt as a positive virtue. We can almost say it's one of our cardinal virtues. Unitarian Universalist history, in many ways, can be seen as a history of doubting. We trace our history back to Bishop Arius in the 3rd century and to Michael Servetus at the time of the Reformation, who had their doubts about the doctrine of the Trinity. We trace our roots back to our Universalist forebears who had a doctrine of universal salvation because they doubted the orthodox idea that a loving God could condemn anybody to eternal damnation. We trace our roots back through a whole history of doubt after doubt after doubt about religious doctrines and religious practices. The value of doubt as a companion of diversity in the context of the ongoing search for truth is wonderfully expressed in that powerful vignette by our own Robert Weston, who another one of my predecessors at First Unitarian Church of Omaha, whom I consider the poet laureate of Unitarian 20th century. "Cherish your doubt," he wrote, "for doubt is the handmaiden of truth. It is the key to the door of knowledge. It is the servant of discovery. A belief which may not be questioned binds us to error, for there is incompleteness and imperfection in every belief. For truth, if it be truth, arises from each testing stronger, more secure." Now, it may be presumptuous and perhaps a little arrogant, but I am sometimes arrogant, but I'm going to use myself and my own religious and intellectual journey as an example of the process I'm trying to describe, a case study in the value of diversity and the value of doubt. Some of you know from hearing me speak from this pulpit on other occasions that although I was raised in a family that had little to do with churches, I've always been interested in religion since I was a boy. I think I was about 12 years old when I wrote this little poem. "The dark of night spreads o'er the day as death goes passing on its way amongst the hearts of those who stray away from God and disobey. The light of day spreads o'er the night when people see the need of right. Death ne'er goes on its faithful plight, and all is peaceful through the night." As a teenager, I fell in love with North Prairie Methodist Church, which I consider to this day to be the most important place in my whole life. I fell in love with the Methodist Youth Fellowship. I fell in love with my minister, Jim Stansbury, who remained a friend of mine until he died a couple of years ago. I fell in love with Methodism. I decided to become a minister when I was about 17 years old. And I went all through college and theological school as a student minister in little country Methodist churches. I was eventually ordained an elder in the Methodist Church. And then 3 years later, in 1964, I decided that I could no longer be a Methodist. I decided to leave what had been one of the great loves of my life and eventually found another one in Unitarian Universalism. 60 years ago, most young people in the area where I grew up were involved in Youth for Christ. That is, by the way, where I met Anne, was at a Youth for Christ meeting. And it was also there that I gave my first sermon, titled, "Why I Am a Christian." 60 years later, give or take a year or two, I gave another sermon from this pulpit, which Michael was afraid to use my title, thought it might be dangerous for me, about why I am an atheist. I began my own religious odyssey as a rather orthodox Christian. I stand before you today as a naturalistic, agnostic humanist. Now, that could be referred to as a radical transformation. I am now a very different person theologically, intellectually, religiously, though I have no anger with my past. What brought about that radical transformation? Well, I think an answer to that might begin for me with my home as a boy. I grew up in a family that loved to argue. A typical family event would be sitting around the table, even when we were kids, drinking coffee and arguing. Our arguments, which were often heated and which probably were mostly about inane subjects, were always ideas about differing opinions in my family. And when I think about that, that may have been the basic training for my later life. All of my life, I've loved to argue. Another source of that transformation may have a lot to do with some basic characteristics of my personality. I think I've always been one uncomfortable with ambiguity. I wanted answers. I never wanted to be deluded. I'm a born explorer. I love to research ideas. Becoming a Unitarian Universalist enhanced that delight in religious exploration for me. In this movement, there were many other points of view, many other belief systems to confront and deal with, a lot of instructive and constructive diversity to argue about. It was as a Unitarian Universalist that I discovered Nietzsche's words, which seemed to describe my own religious journey. If you wish to strive for peace of soul and pleasure, then believe. If you wish to be a devotee of truth, then inquire. And it was the interplay between diversity of opinion and doubt, as I engaged in my search for truth, that brought me to the intellectual and religious positions I hold today. And if I can be persuaded that my present views are in error, I hope that I am still capable of changing and growing. So let me see if I can bring all these thoughts together in a few sentences. One, diversity of religious opinion holds an important place in both contemporary Unitarian Universalist experience and our heritage. Two, the value of diversity lies not in and of itself, but along with the virtue of doubt as an aspect of an overarching value in liberal religion. And that overarching value is the never-ending search for truth. That never-ending search for truth, number three, is guided in liberalism by reason as the ultimate authority. Number four or five, what I've called an obsession with diversity, that is the prevailing tendency to see diversity as the most important aspect of liberal religion, tends to move us in the direction of chaos, to dilettantism, to the absurd conclusion that all opinions are created equal, to ideological irrelevancy in the wider world of religious movements. Six, whatever may be the place in diversity in which we now as individuals find ourselves, find yourselves, whether we be Christian or humanist or theist or atheist or pagan or naturalist, whatever, we ought to see ourselves in a constant encounter with other ideas, because that is the pathway to religious growth. So to return to my introductory metaphor, we should not see ourselves, you should not see yourselves, as a congregation or a fellowship or a larger movement where we climb on our individual horses and ride off in all four directions at the same time. We should see ourselves as a congregation or a fellowship or a movement where we all climb on our individual horses, perhaps even getting new mounts, changing them now and then, but always riding off together with other liberals throughout history in the same direction, that is, in the direction of the never-ending search for truth. Thank you. you want to moderate this? Yeah. Huh? Moderate, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you.
How do I do this with you?
I mean, just find out what you're.
All right. Okay. All right. You there's some answers out there.
Thanks for that. Tom Phillips, thanks for putting me on this thought path when we started, because when I read about the Phelps group being in town this morning, I immediately thought, well, they're going to be in front of us, because we tolerate diversity of the kind you specified. And I just had this vision that we would be out here in front inviting them to come in and argue with us. Is that the difference? I don't know. Is that too tolerant? What do we do?
You got a question?
Where?
Huh? Do we invite those people in?
Oh, yeah. Should we invite those people in? Not me. As a matter of fact, when I spoke up in Sioux Falls and talked about the young man who called, about the young gay who called, and they said we should welcome him into our churches and help our discussion. Well, I want to welcome him into our churches, but it can't help our discussions at all. And so that, I don't know, I reach a point where I no longer have much interest in being civil with those jerks. For many years in Omaha, I escorted at the women's center where abortions were performed. I did it over a number of years. The protesters out there were mostly men. They developed these, they called me the minister of mayhem and pastor disaster. And I had no interest in being in dialogue with those guys. And if I ever did, I called them names. So I don't know. I'm not virtuous enough.
Marilyn Caldwell over here. I'm a skeptic. I get the Skeptical Inquirer, which I read with great interest every single month. And I keep wondering why skeptics don't come to the Unitarian Church, but I think that you just pinned it down. The Unitarians aren't as skeptical as they should be. I appreciate the research that goes on among the skeptics. When they see something that doesn't look right, they research it. And I want to have answers. And they provide answers to the point that they can provide it. We probably should add a little bit more skepticism to our services. The other thing is, very good friend of mine died about a week ago. We went to his funeral. He had helped us set up a mystery convention in this town, and he was so much a part of that convention that I was just devastated. He was only 2 years older than my oldest son when he died. And he knew I was an atheist, and he still worked with us. He was a Baptist. So we went to his funeral. And after far too much about Jesus and God and very little about Bob Clare, we walked out. We couldn't take it anymore. So I believe in honoring the person who died.
I might make a comment here with what you just said. When I don't know if I ever mentioned this. Oh. I don't know if I ever mentioned this, but when my father died, Well, my mother died first, and my father remarried a Wisconsin Synod Lutheran woman. If you know anything about the Lutherans, they're the most conservative body, more conservative than the Missouri Synod. And then my father died, and his funeral was at my stepmother's church, the Wisconsin Synod Lutheran Church. And the minister was so, I'm not sure what the word would be, upset with my presence there as a Unitarian, that he started the service by saying, there are people here who believe differently than we do, but we have to bear witness to our faith. And I thought that was fine. They did. But then he gave a 10-minute homily on a defense of the Trinity, Trinitarian thought against Unitarian thought at my father's funeral. I got even with this. That after the service, there was somebody, my stepmother had the idea that the flowers from my father's service had to be put on my real mother's grave. I don't know where she got that idea, but so my younger brother, that was Dale, by the way, my younger brother and I went out and got and took the flowers out to my real mother's grave, but we left one big, beautiful spray of flowers on that chancel of that Wisconsin Synod Lutheran Church. The spray had a label on it, First Unitarian Church of Omaha.
I have two thoughts. The first has to do with your discussion about diversity. I think any educator here will agree with me when we say our elementary and secondary schools now have a curriculum that is 100 miles wide and 1 inch thick. And I see that affecting how the students that come before me at the university react. They know a lot of stuff about a lot of things, but they know very little about really in-depth things. And part of that, I think, is society. We've become extremely compartmentalized. You know, you become really good at doing one thing. And if anything, the recent economic crisis has showed us is that that sets you up to not be able to have a job, especially if your jobs are sent overseas. But I think, like Kathy over there and Kathy in the front row up there, will agree with me that our curriculum sort of reflects what you're saying there. We don't go down deep much anymore, and we don't really try to get into those deeper, higher-order thinking skills of analyzing and synthesizing and understanding how things work together. That's one thing. The other thing is, in the discussion about Fred Phelps, I don't spend any time on Fred Phelps. I probably got 50 emails yesterday saying, are you going to come protest Fred Phelps? I don't. He doesn't deserve my time. And I think liberals have this terrible habit of thinking we have to give respect to other people. At a certain point, you have to say, these people are beyond reason. They're not going to listen to you. And to do, it's just a waste of time. You know, do something more constructive with your time than trying to convince Fred Phelps that he's wrong. But I see that play out time and time again, be it at the national level on the discussion about national health care or something more local. We tend to give these people more dignity than they're due. And as a result, we're getting shortchanged as a nation, as a culture, as a society.
I'm Jim Chantel again. My first talk as a Unitarian, which was down on Bluemont Avenue, down in that home down there that Inez Alsop had contributed for us to meet in, was on to give a survey, actually, out on religious values that had been given to many different denominations around the country, and was actually published. And so I gave the same survey out to the then Unitarians. I'm sure we get the same results today. What it showed was that among traditional religions, especially the more fundamentalists, was that there was a great deal of agreement among their congregations about what it was that they thought was a positive aspect of their religion. Among Unitarians, what we agreed on was that those values didn't matter to us. We couldn't agree on what we did agree on, but we couldn't agree what was positive, but we knew what we didn't like. And at the top of the list of what was important to the fundamentalist religions was eternal salvation. What was least important to Unitarians was eternal salvation.
Was what?
Eternal salvation.
Yeah. Now, you may be talking about the Rokeach value survey.
Right. That was it. And I actually did it later. After we moved here, I did the same thing again, gave that same survey out, got the same results. My conclusion, we don't always know what we agree on, but we know we can agree on what we don't believe in. And what we don't believe in is what those more fundamentalist people find as the number one value in their life. I don't know how you have a discussion between people who have eternal salvation as their goal in religion and Unitarians who think that's the least important thing.
Yeah, salvation was, for the fundamentalist, the first list for Unitarian Universalists, it was the last one on the list.
Honor Franklin, I think argument and loving to argue is at the crux of the answer. And I think, if we could have some organized way of getting together and sharing our disagreements within the Unitarian Fellowship, and getting to know each other and looking for truth together, that we would get a clearer picture of what we all want, and we wouldn't just have to concentrate on the fact that we don't agree with other people.
I think, let me say something to that, too. It's, Roy Phillips. Yeah, Roy and I were, he was minister of St. Paul, Unity Church, and sort of the opposite end of the religious spectrum from me. He's very close, Roy, until he died, a very close friend. But we had some marvelous arguments and discussions, sometimes lasting hours. And I wish more Unitarians would get in the argumentative mode. You don't have to dislike people to argue with them.
Reverend Knapp, Tom Phillips, fallen Methodist also. So we actually had a consultant come from UUA to help us. We had a consultant come from UUA. That stands for Unitarian Universalists of America? Association, okay. So maybe it's international, I don't know. Anyway, there was money involved, and she gave us recommendations, and one was to come up with a vision. Now, you've told us that we've got so much on diversity, but we're really thin on depth.
Depth.
That may be redundant, but...
on what unites us, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any advice for us? Besides, can you distill the sermon from 5 points down to one or two?
I'm just a voice crying in the wilderness. What kind of advice? Just realize that the only advice I can give you is to realize that whatever your own individual opinions are, they should not be so solidly fixed that you can't change, which I see is happening. That there is ways of arguing with one another and changing and growing. My own feeling is that through all my history as a unit, 43 or 44 years now as a Unitarian Universalist, wave after wave of fads have gone through this movement. People thinking they're the end, and they're really not. And that's probably going to continue, and we need to continue to explore it. I got to stop talking. I'll answer any more questions. What I'm saying is I'm a windbag, and I love to talk.
Okay, I have one comment. Ken Embers, I just returned from Korea teaching English there to college students for a couple of weeks, and I read a survey there that 46 to 50% of those people have no, don't identify with any religious denomination, and I thought that was refreshing. The other 30, there's 30% were Christian and only 20% Buddhist. I thought most of them would be Buddhist, but they don't really identify. Anyway, it was nice to be in another culture and look at their values and beliefs, and to me it's so much more interesting than discussing like Phelps' views and those, to go to another culture. But to give your topic and your mission a sense of urgency and immediacy, I picked up one gem of wisdom when I was there, and it was that time flies, but you're the pilot.
That's a good one.
Thank you.
All right, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Another Unitarian Universalist hymn, by the way.
Yes. The closing hymn is number 287, Faith of the Larger Liberty. Again, a tune that has had lots of different sets of words, none of them any better than these. 287.
I'm closing with some words from John Tyndall. It's from the Belfast Address. John Tyndall lived from 1820 to 1893 and was at the time an eminent physicist. I read them to you because I love the words. It is entirely possible for you and me to purchase intellectual peace at the price of intellectual death. The world is not without refugees of this description, nor is it wanting in persons who seek their shelter and try to persuade others to do the same. The unstable and the weak have yielded and will yield to this persuasion, and they to whom repose is sweeter than truth. But I would exhort you to refuse the offered shelter and to scorn the base repose, to accept, if the choice be forced upon you, commotion before stagnation, the leap of the torrent before the stillness of the swamp.
A lot of fun.